Welcome to Failing Up. We don't have a theme song.
Well, we might not have a theme song, Eden, but we do have a theme, and that is failure.
And we talk to people about their failures and mistakes and how they grew from it.
Simple as that. Listen up.
All right.
Yeah.
Welcome to Failing Up. This is Guy.
Hi, Guy.
Hi, Eden. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
That was an awkward start to the show.
I know.
But thank you for having me. Of course, as always, inviting me to
you
your
You don't have to
home.
Say that, because this is also, we share podcasts.
We do share podcasts.
This is your equipment.
I'm very excited to be here, though, as always, on Failing Up. So thank you so much. We have a very special guest today.
Yes, we do.
Do you want to introduce our special guest?
I thought we have agreed that you did, I did it last time, so you can do it.
Okay. He's a star of film and television, and he's a musician, and his name... Oh, there he is. Josh Radner. Thank you so much for being here, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
You were born in Columbus, Ohio.
That's correct.
I spent 2.5 years, by the way, in Columbus, Ohio. Dublin. So I'm familiar with that area.
What were you doing there?
I was working for a software company, and we moved to Dublin, right next to the Quest building, Q-W-E-S-T. It's a Quest Communications building. Everybody knows it in that area.
Not the protein bar.
No. And I
not the blood drawing place.
No.
Oh, right. Quest Diagnostics,
correct.
Of course.
And actually, the weirder part was I was working for a company called Quest Software, Q-U-E-S-T. So
you must have gotten a lot of weird calls.
Yes. I was like,
Where's my urine sample?
I work for Quest. Oh, right off the highway? Yes, but not that building. The next, that's a different Quest. So you're born in Columbus. And right before the show, I was saying we have... There's a similarity that I felt, and I'm like, wow, this is a weird one. This is a connection I don't usually have with people. I'm a conservative Jew.
Sure.
I went to a Orthodox...
But like conservative, not politically.
Yeah, no, not right.
Politically. You're not Ben Shapiro.
No!
thank God. But no, but you know, for people who know... It's
Did
reform.
You grow up conservative? I didn't know this.
Yeah, technically I went to a conservative temple, but I went to an Orthodox Jewish school growing up. That was my...
Just like your guest today.
Yes. Pre-K through sixth grade I went.
I went through eighth grade.
See, at sixth grade I said, I kind of want to go to a public school. I just knew that
there was... And where'd you grow up? There.
In Lakewood, New Jersey.
Sure.
Yeah, but it's a
but
very
that's a
similar,
Jewy area.
Oh, yeah. It's like so the most Orthodox Jews, like anywhere outside of Israel, I'm pretty sure.
Really?
Is in Lakewood, New Jersey currently.
That's the other homeland.
So, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, that is a weird kind of like connection, to especially being conservative and growing up in an Orthodox. I'll give you, maybe you'll have something like this. So I go to this Orthodox school. We went to Maine for a vacation when I was a kid. I came back. I wore a shirt to school. It said Maine, where lobster is king.
Oh, no.
And they're like, you cannot wear this here.
You can't do that.
Just like I couldn't wear the shirt that said, this is my Halloween costume. They're like, no, we don't celebrate Halloween.
Like 2 days a week where they would make lunch for us. And then 3 days a week we'd have to bring our own. And the daughter of like the Chabad rabbi in town, she would kind of police our lunches.
Oh, wow.
Like she would kind of look
That's
and
not
see.
Fun.
Who was violating the kashrut.
Wow.
Her dad, incidentally, was arrested twice for soliciting prostitutes. So I don't look to her as a kind of moral arbiter of much.
That's amazing.
Not her fault.
And she's like, that is treif. You cannot eat that in your school.
Yeah. I am dying for like a high school soap drama about these schools. Yes, I can see it.
About Orthodox Hebrew schools?
Yeah.
Like a Degrassi, but like Orthodox?
Right. Yeah. I want to see this police person. I want to see this Chabad person get arrested. This is fascinating.
He brought shrimp cocktail to lunch. Dun, dun, dun.
But were you like kosher at home?
No.
Okay.
No, I mean, not really. We didn't do, like, it was never like milk on the table with like steak, right?
Oh, really?
So we didn't do milk and meat.
Okay. Yeah.
We didn't do, like, we never had bacon in the house, but we'd bring in McDonald's. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I have a very similar situation. That's funny.
Really?
Definitely no milk exinflations. So you're not doing that.
Yeah. I remember I was a swimmer too. So this kid who lived in Westerville, my friend Denny, invited me over to sleep over. And his mom made dinner, and I sat down at the dinner and they're having steak. And there were these giant glasses of milk on the table.
Oh, no.
And it was like a horror movie shot. Like it just zoomed in right on the milk, you know? And it was like, I started sweating. And I was like, what do I do?
Right.
And I didn't know, I didn't want to be like, I can't drink milk with the meat. And, you know, I didn't want to explain it to them. So I think I just didn't drink the milk.
I just
choked down the steak.
Oh, no.
But it was really, I remember it so vividly. Like, I'm not supposed to drink milk with the steak.
Right.
Who drinks milk at a meal?
People in Westerville, I guess. God, we're up so to that. Weird. Yeah, no, but see, it's because you're Jewish, the idea of milk with dinner is like insane.
Right. Yeah. Revolting. Yeah. Well, I think only a serial killers do that kind of stuff. Like, I'm going to drink a glass of milk. I don't know.
I think we forget that was the 80s, right? Like, right. We're now like, no, don't drink a glass of milk. Maybe a touch in your coffee at most.
Right. Right. Yeah. Like, you know, have cashew milk at least.
Yeah, but that's, we've been in California a while.
I know. I feel like my mom was Israeli, so they don't believe in, they don't think they have to follow any rules.
Nothing.
Yeah. So we had bacon, no problem. But yeah, I just remember at school, my mom actually packed me a ham sandwich.
Yeah.
And I went to a Jewish reform, but Jewish.
Yeah.
And when teachers looked at that sandwich, they were like, that is not turkey.
Yeah.
And I did not know what was wrong. But I mean,
it's also so weird how you're given these things that are kind of unexamined. Like, I actually went back and I've thought about a lot of the stuff I grew up with, but I've approached it with an adult's perspective. I'm like, well, some of that's wise. Some of that I don't care about. But I feel like it's such a weird thing to just inherit this set of beliefs, especially around like dietary laws and stuff. And you don't really know why you're doing it.
Yeah.
And I wonder the wisdom of following something if you simply don't know why you're doing it. Otherwise, you're just in some weird cult that has like weird rules.
I know.
But I do think like being conscious around food seems like a wise thing.
Yeah.
You know, I think everyone has to come to their own thing around it. But
yeah. But I mean, I think I went to Jewish high school, and then we really learned why everything is the way it is. Mm-hmm. And it was just like a cleanliness type thing. You know, like back in the day, it was hard to store things. So
kosher means clean.
Yeah, I
the best definition I heard of it, I went to Israel right in between my first and second year of drama school, and this teacher that I had said this great thing that every law in Judaism essentially is about separating us from like the animals. So like you have fire that can destroy or it can illuminate things and cook your food. So you harness a little bit of it and bless it on the Sabbath. Mm. And you have food that you can obviously gorge yourself to death or you can be, you know, conscious about it. You have wine that can obviously lead to destruction or you can harness a little bit of it and sanctify it.
Right.
So it's all about taking these things that can be out of control
in moderation
and kind of revealing the divinity in them, which I think is pretty rad.
That is pretty cool.
Yeah.
I like my religion. I mean, I'm a fan.
Do you still consider yourself are you a practicing Jew?
I mean, here's the thing. I definitely identify as Jewish, and I think it's important for me to maybe raise my kids Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't go to temple very often, if at all. And if I do, it's Yom Kippur and it's Kol Nidre.
Right.
But my parents were buried Jewish, and I made sure, and I really wanted them to be buried Jewish when they died, and that's important to me. I would, you know, I think traditions are important to me. I mm-hmm. like the fact of like getting friends together for Shabbat. I think that's a cool thing.
Are you fasting on Yom Kippur?
I haven't fasted in a while.
No, okay. No.
But is that...
That's like the one thing I do is fast on
Yom Kippur. My dad, that was the one thing he did. But to me, he always said, well, I feel like this is a tradition and I feel like connected to what my dad did and what his dad did.
Right,
so
right.
But is it out of some filial obligation / guilt or is it something that motivates you beyond that?
I think something guilt. That motivates me a little bit. I like feeling part of something, and I do like the idea that my parents did it, and then I'm doing
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's something, I get like memories. I liked my school. You know, I liked celebrating Shabbat in my school. I liked getting dressed nicely on Friday. I went to a Jewish summer camp too, which was too, like one
those exist.
Which exists, but they're kind of naughty. but I like the traditions.
It's hookup camp.
Yeah, it's hookup camp. It's you know, I got more action in that camp.
It's like Jewish parents are like, we're not going to tell you about sex. We're just sending you to Jewish summer camp.
Exactly.
You'll like, figure it out.
You'll let the you know the counselor in training do something and figure that out
wow.
for you. Yep. But I liked the traditions there, and I liked you know not cooking.
The traditions.
Well, getting felt up.
It's a different set of traditions.
It's awesome.
No. they were really, but they like taught people a lot of really interesting things. Mm-hmm. But it's very socialistic. I must say, it was very like kibbutz type of mentality. Like you got to work, and everybody has to do their share.
Wow!
And this is 1995 or 96. So
the one year I went to like a Jewish, the only time I went to camp was a Jewish camp in eighth grade, and it was like go play tennis and swim.
Oh,
and
that's a day camp.
Art?
That's different.
No, we slept there.
Away?
Oh yeah, okay. It was like a old school Boy Scout camp actually.
That doesn't sound
A lot of, there wasn't a ton of feeling up. There was some, but not a ton. I didn't get felt up.
It was a youth movement when I went to, so I felt a little, I don't know. But anyway,
I do feel... Let's talk about Josh some.
Right, I'm sorry. I'm getting off on
topic. What's a young Josh? Is he... Do you have an idea what you want to do for, you know, the rest of your life? Did you always want to be an actor?
No.
Or an artist?
No. No. I mean, I had really bad asthma when I was a kid, so I was like a visual artist, you know, like when I had to calm down or couldn't go outside. So I was really into visual art. I love that. I learned to juggle when I was a kid. So I was like,
whoa,
had this juggling thing.
Can you still juggle?
Yeah, I'm a pretty good juggler.
Wow. Actually, really. That's a little hidden talent.
Yeah. I can juggle 5 balls.
Wow.
Wow.
That's difficult.
Yeah. But it's one of those things, you know, like kids who start playing guitar young, they can just shred it. And it's like, I don't think about it. I'm just a good juggler because I started doing it when I was 5 or 6.
Right.
But I don't even know that I was drawn to like performance. I was really good at school. But I did the least amount of work to get the maximum effect that I could get. And I kind of thought, you know, I'm like a suburban guy from Columbus, Ohio, like, and my dad was a lawyer, and I just kind of assumed maybe that's what I'd do. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have any great love of the law. I didn't know what he did, really. But then when I was 15, I started doing musicals at school, and a year later I did the MC and Cabaret, and it kind of like changed everything for me, and I just never stopped.
What was the impetus to start performing in school? Was it, hey, I took a theater arts class?
No, my friend Debbie Schell wanted to audition for the chorus of Oklahoma, and she was nervous, and she asked me to sit with her and just keep her company. And I thought the guys that were auditioning, I was like, these guys are not great. And they asked me if I wanted to audition, and the next thing I knew I was, and I got one of the leads.
Wow.
It was like half accidental. But then once I did it, it felt kind of, you know,
right.
It felt right.
Yes.
As a musical theater nerd myself in high school, I would have hated that your guts because you were absolutely. Like, I'm going to
Well, my sister,
audition.
Melanie, my older sister, had worked for years, like working her way up, you know, chorus and then
right,
a smaller
exactly.
role. And so that was her year to get a great part. And her little brother just swooped in.
Wow.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
And then you do Cabaret, and that opens your eyes like, wow, I could do this for a living?
Yeah, that was the next year. I just did like a straight up Joel Grey impersonation. I just danced around my parents' house when they were gone, you know, singing along to the Cast album. But I did kind of a great Joel Grey impersonation, and I was kind of deft with the cane and the dance. You know, I just was able to pull it off. I didn't understand like the sexual, you know, fluidity of the part.
Sure.
But I definitely had a little showbiz razzmatazz for a 16-year-old. And certain people that I really trusted were like pulling me aside and saying like, don't ever stop doing this. Like, this is something you need to keep doing. So I got, I had these people at very formative moments pull me aside and just tell me, even when I didn't believe in myself, like you can do this, you know?
That's interesting. I always tell people that I think that's the only reason I still work is because I've had people that I respect tell me, oh no, like you're good. Keep going.
Yeah. I think a lot of times when you don't believe in yourself, it's almost like you have to export belief to someone else to hold it for you until you're ready to pick it up yourself.
Yeah. It's hard for us to see it in ourselves because we're so judgmental.
Yeah, and we literally can't see ourselves.
Yeah.
Like someone else can see us.
Right.
And can often see us more clearly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So after, I guess, high school, do you go to college?
Yeah, I went to Kenyon College, which was in Ohio. It was a very small school, but had a great theater program.
Question for you. Are you an Ohio State fan first?
Yes.
Okay, Eden, this is the weirdest thing. And this is what I learned from living in Ohio for 2.5 years.
Okay.
I'm from New Jersey. I went to Rutgers. I don't care if Seton Hall was the State University of New Jersey, even though it's Rutgers. I would not ever root for Seton Hall. You root for your team in Ohio. It's the weirdest thing. It doesn't matter what school you went to. You root for Ohio State and your school. But even Ohio State, like more importantly than your school, in a sense.
You mean more than Kenyon?
Well, just in
general. Kenyon was a D3.
I don't care where you went to in Ohio. Like, I know people, they're like, I went to OU, but I'm an OSU fan.
First. Yeah, Ohio State athletics and the football in particular is exerts such a pull on the whole state, except up in Toledo they have a couple of Michigan fans because it's right on the so it gets weird up there. Families are pitted against each other. But I loved Ohio State when I was a kid. I would go to games and stuff. But it's more like I just know how much my dad cares, my friends care. It's like when they're winning, everyone's on antidepressants, and when they're not, everyone's crushed.
Yeah.
So I understand what it does to the mood of my town.
like at bowl game, like national championship games, something like 98% of all televisions that were turned on mm-hmm. in Central Ohio were turned on to the game.
Wow.
Like 98%. I mean, it pervades everything.
One time they were like the backup alumni band came to my office. The entire office.
Quest?
Yes, the entire office just emptied. And I'm like, what's going on? They're like, oh, the alumni backup Ohio State band is here.
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't move me out of my chair, let alone, you know, outside in the back to watch this thing.
The Seton Hall backup.
Yeah, no, Rutgers. Oh, Rutgers. Has to be the Rutgers stuff, yes.
Jesus.
So, I'm sorry, I had to know. So, you went to Kenyon College, you're with the intent of being an actor.
I did, but I kind of hid that from my parents. I was an English major at first, and then I switched over to be a drama major, but
are your parents the kind that would have like said no, that's not a good idea?
They were not like bohemian artists who wanted me to like right. you know, do whatever and sure. live in a van. They're not those people.
Yeah. Most Jews aren't.
And they were very nervous, and I you know, my dad is a lawyer, as I said, so I really had to dole it out judiciously, and I would, you know, present a case basically about this is why I should go to this apprentice program in the summer, and this is why I should declare a drama major. And I really did my research, and I never came at him kind of emotionally. I just came at him with facts, and I was like, I think this is what I should do. And then when it was time to go to grad school, I said, I got into NYU, which is the school I wanted to get into. And I said, I can teach if, you know, I can always teach, like I'll have a master's. So they were incredibly nervous, and my dad very sweetly didn't reveal to me how terrified he was until years later. Mm-hmm. But he wrote a really great article for the American Bar Association about having your son, like having a kid who wants to be an artist as a lawyer. How do you handle it? And he's become in our town like the resident expert of like, my kid wants to be an artist. What do I do?
Oh, boy.
So they all come to my dad, you know, which is so sweet, though.
That because, is kind of nice, yeah.
Because now, let me say, if I hadn't been successful, I think it would have been a different story. Sure. I think I was able to like show him I'm not crazy. I really can do this. And now he's thrilled, and you know,
that's so great.
Yeah.
And what does he recommend? Breathing through the nose and then through the mouth.
I'll send you guys the article. I mean, that's I think he just told about our journey and our negotiation around everything.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. My dad was an engineer, and I felt though he had guilt for my mom dying when I was young, to like not tell me no, don't do what you really want to do.
Right.
And people would tell me, no, your daughter's very funny, and he would never read my funny stuff.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he didn't, I mean, he was funny, but not like, he didn't really have a great sense
of humor.
How
old were you when your mom died?
I was 13.
Oh, wow.
So I think he always just had guilt. So when I was like, you know, doing artsy things and comedy things, people would tell me, you know, your daughter's really great. You should read the stuff. Some of it's online. And he was just like, nah, she's just, I think he deep down was an engineer and was like, I want her to be a doctor or a lawyer. Really? But he was like, I'm not going to tell her no, because I feel bad.
Wow.
But I feel like that is a thing that a lot of, I don't know, dads or people that have jobs that are very practical, you know, they have this fear of their kids doing something that where the stability of the job is like non-consistent.
Yeah.
And like, you know.
Well, interestingly, I just read this thing that so many jobs that we just take for granted, like, oh, no, that's a good, solid job. They're going to go away because things are starting to get automated. Like I you know, when you go to CVS and they're like, the checkout people are showing you how to do your own checkout thing with those machines. And I'm like, you're engineering your own obsolescence. Like, like that's taking away your job. It's so odd.
Yeah.
But the capital, like the thing to have in the 21st century, they say is like creativity is one of the great, because you can't outsource it to robots.
Well, I mean
you could, but
they had that robot write that screenplay, which I got mad about.
Really?
Yeah. Didn't you see on Twitter?
No.
Like
no.
This robot created a screenplay.
And was it good?
No.
But you know what? Most of the ones by humans aren't either.
But the ones by humans
aren't
either.
So he's at least in there. He's competitive.
I mean, he stands out. Like, you know, they're going to be like, this guy's got something. You know, he's the diversity hire of that. I don't know. They need one robot in the room, right? In the writer's room. Just like, we got a female. We got a Latino.
I have a joke that...
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the joke?
No, I can't say it. It's so dumb. I'll tell you afterwards.
Okay, great.
I'll remember it.
So you're in college. So you went to NYU.
I went to NYU to Tisch right after,
Amazing. Yeah, so you're also teaching the
one? No, I never taught.
Okay, just tell that to your dad.
Yeah.
Good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't mind. I think I would probably love teaching. I don't know if I'd like to teach acting, actually. I'd like to teach a whole bunch of other things. But that never felt like a nightmare scenario to me or anything. Yeah. but I just never have.
And how was grad school? Do you like that?
It was really good. It was really hard. It was a really exciting time when I was there. Like, a lot of people have done incredible stuff. Mahershala Ali was a year behind me.
Oh, wow.
The Oscar for Moonlight. And Sterling Brown was 2 years behind me. Hmm. And just all these people were, you know, it was just a real, the professors there were amazing and super small. Like, there were 17 people in my class. And I was neurotic. I was really nervous about, am I going to be able to really do this? Like, we had, you know, the alumni board, and you'd see, like, who was up there, you know, Billy Crudup and Marcia Gay Harden and, like, all the Deborah Messing and all the people. And you were like, am I going to be up there one day?
Right.
Because a lot of their classmates were not, you know?
Yeah.
Michael C. Hall and Peter Krause. Like, there were just a lot of NYU people out there doing it. And I wanted to be one of them. And I didn't know if I would be. So I was really, I was nervous the second year. I didn't know if I wanted to be an actor. It was the first time I really questioned it. And I was like, I'm in so deep right now. Like, how am I going to tell my dad I want out, you know?
Right.
And I really had a moment of deep fear around it. And I just buckled down and kept doing it. And in between my second and third year, I went to the Guthrie. They had a summer experience for people going into their last year of grad school. And I worked with this great man, Ken Washington, who ended up directing me in a play called Awake and Sing my third year at NYU. And he really, something about that summer in Minneapolis really like revitalized me and made me feel like, no, I still love this. I still love this.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, you're not sleeping. You're in class all day long and rehearsing all night.
Yeah.
And you're doing it 6 days a week. And it's just, you lose a sense of like who you are outside of it. Like, I probably never worked. Well, I don't know if that's true. I've directed movies, which is like the most all-consuming
thing.
But for a long time, the hardest I ever worked was in grad school.
Yeah.
You know? And then you get out of school and you're unhooked from this schedule that you've been on. And I didn't have a gap year. I went right out. So I had to learn how to like feed myself and what to do with hours. Like, I always made enough to not get a day job, but I would have cavernous hours to fill. So much of it became about like the psychology of staying sane when you weren't working.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And what'd you figure out?
Well, it turned me into a writer, ultimately.
Huh.
Like, I started to feel... I mean, a couple things. When I first got out of school, there are certain people that get signed by big agencies. I was actually one of them. I signed with a really good agency. But there are certain people that just start working in movies right away. And you're like, wait, how does that happen? Like, certain people didn't even get agents. Certain people can't get work. It takes you a while to figure out how to audition and how to do all that. I learned very quickly, like, not to sit around with my friends and talk about how hard it was to get work.
Yeah.
I just felt like that was such a self-defeating loop of grievance and resentment. And I was like, this does not serve me or anyone. So I started writing in earnest when my girlfriend at the time was living out in LA, and I moved out here to be with her. And I worked. I got my first pilot audition for it, but I got fired from it. And then I did another series that got canceled after 3 episodes, and I did The Graduate on Broadway. And
wait, let's back up for a second. Why'd you get fired from your first pilot?
I don't know. You'll have to ask the people at the WB.
You don't even know why you got fired.
No, they just didn't like me.
Wow. Was that devastating to you when that
happened? Yeah, it was crushing. Crushing.
That I feel like that happens though.
It happens all the time, but
think about that. You get a pilot. That's hard enough, and then you do it, and then you get fired.
Yeah, they pick it up. They pick it up. So you're waiting to hear if it's been picked up, and you hear the day everyone hears it gets picked up is the day you hear you get fired.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
I feel like it happens. And they never did they tell you why? No.
It was just this woman at the network just had it out for me. And the producer said, you can't fire him. And they're like, well, then we're not picking up your show. Like, it was, they demanded it. But the interesting thing was, it was a real moment of reckoning for me because you know, that which doesn't kill you. Like, I really got so much stronger after that. Like, it was a real crisis moment where I was like, oh, do I take the LSATs? Like, what do I do right now? And I was like, I really had to decide, is Hollywood telling me to go away? Or is it just this one woman telling me to go away? Right. And then I started learning about all the very famous people who'd been fired from pilots.
Oh, yeah.
And it started making me feel maybe that was okay.
My writing partner on my movie that I'm writing was fired from South Park her third week in, because she quote unquote had a weird vibe.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, and I have,
she knows why.
I have stories like this too. And my therapist used to tell me, she still does. She's like, oh, it builds a callus. Like, it's going to.
Yeah. And you need them. Like, you need, I mean, everyone wants like a magic carpet ride with no obstruction.
Yeah.
Like, that's what your ego wants.
Sure.
But the thing that's going to make you like truly like a veteran and an artist, like lately I just did this show Rise that I loved so much for NBC. And I really thought it was going to run for a couple years because it was so good. And I felt like it was so necessary. And it was like all guns firing. And they just didn't pick it up for a second season. And I was really sad, but I was sad in a different way. Yeah. I wasn't sad in the way that you are when you're in your mid-20s and you get your first thing and you're like, oh, this is going to save my life.
Right.
And then you get, you know, I was on a hit show that didn't save my life. And, you know, like, sure. So I know that none of these things save your life or ruin your life or anything. So I had this kind of like grizzled veteran thing where I was like,
yeah.
Well, you know, sometimes they work and sometimes they call your number and sometimes, you know.
Yeah.
And then I had this movie that I shot in Austin, this little film that I never thought would see the light of day, and somehow it got picked up for distribution. So I'm at the premiere and I'm like, I don't understand anything. Like, yeah. I don't know this business. Like, and you know, like William Goldman said, nobody knows anything, and it's true. But there is something like, there's a relief in having been at it long enough that you're a little calloused. Not in a way that you're not emotionally
sure.
limber,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
but in a way that you're just like, your whole life doesn't rise and fall with your employment or whether people care what you're doing.
Right. You know? Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's with every industry. I don't think it's Hollywood. I think people in tech and people, you know, I guess like even doctors, like, oh, they don't get some tenure or something. Like, it's just, it's important to just stay grounded and be like, all right.
The best thing I ever heard about this was, I had dinner with John Patrick Shanley, the playwright, and a couple friends at Vassar, where I've done a lot of theater work. And he just said this thing about, someone was saying they were trying to start this thing, and they said, it's a real struggle. And he was like, everything's a struggle. Everything's a struggle. He's like, you're yeah. never going to escape struggle. The mind wants to escape struggle, but you can't. It's just part of it. He said, the trick to life is find what you love to do and struggle at that.
Mm,
and
yeah.
I was like, yeah, that's it.
Because you everything. Feel better at least doing it. At least
well, I mean, I think I look at some people who look so uninspired by their jobs, whatever it is, and I'm just like, and you know, I never am super excited for weekends. Like, I don't care about them as the way other people do.
Yeah,
just because
same.
It doesn't mean anything right. to me Friday, Saturday,
that's
because like everything is, every yeah. day is kind of mine to,
sure.
unless I'm working, and then it's really like, I do need a couple days off, but largely,
yeah.
This is going to annoy people.
Life.
I don't know what day it is. Sometimes I'm like, what is today? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you live in this whole weird, windy world that's different than other people. But I think about, you know, people who like are dying for vacations and dying for Friday night. And I'm like, I think there was something about watching my dad come home, like, looking like the weight of the world on his shoulders, kind of Willie Loman style. And
right.
being like, maybe I don't think I want to put on a suit and go to an office every day.
Right. Yeah, you know? Absolutely. I mean, I learned when I was a kid, I immediately got internships and stuff. When I was like 14, I worked for like the Jewish Federation. And
yeah.
when I was 16, I was a PA on a movie. Like, and I learned, oh, I don't belong in an office, so I'm going to be on a movie set instead.
Yeah.
Like, I knew like, oh, this isn't my thing. I can't jive. And I think also seeing my dad, all like, he was his own entrepreneur, so he like never had weekends because he would still work at home
yeah.
and go to the office. So, but now as like, I guess, an artist, I go to Trader Joe's and they're like, coming back from work, and I'm like, I'm never not really working, but yeah. I'm also never working.
Yeah. I remember also I was an acting apprentice at Vassar, New York Stage and Film, in between my junior and sophomore year of college. And I remember there were, you know, it was like John Slattery and Patty Clarkson and all these amazing actors, and they all knew each other. It's so weird to think I'm older than them now. I'm older now than
you
they
are?
Were then. Yeah. I mean, they were like in their 30s, right?
Right.
Or like early 40s or something. But they all loved each other and were laughing and drinking. And I was just like, I want to be a part of that community.
Mm.
That looks fun to me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And here you are. You're part of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
look
amazing.
At how far you've come.
It's for amazing. You, when did you feel like, and I'm going to say pre, you know, the big one, How I Met Your Mother, when did you feel for you like, oh, I got my first break?
You know, I know this is going to sound so annoying. Every job's a break.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, it's hard to get acting jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just
right.
is. And
So for you, literally the first acting job was your
yeah,
first
I mean, I got process. My I got my equity card at Manhattan Theater Club understudying this play off Broadway right when I got out of school. It was before I even had an agent. The casting
wow.
director brought me in. So weird. I just did a reading there last week and saw her, this casting director.
Wow.
Yeah. She's still there, Nancy Piccioni. She's lovely. And then I did a play at Baltimore Center Stage, and I mean... Every job felt like a big deal. I think something happened to me when I got The Graduate
mm-hmm.
on Broadway, because it was Kathleen Turner and Alicia Silverstone, and it was not a well-reviewed play, but it was a huge hit. It
right.
was a huge hit. And Jason Biggs was leaving for a couple months to do these movies or a movie, and they needed to replace him. So I didn't have to get reviewed. I was on this Sally Field show called The Court that got canceled after 3 episodes. We shot 6. So that was my first big TV job after getting fired from the pilot. So I did the Sally Field show, and then I got The Graduate. And then it's like my face that was like my enormous picture of my face in between Kathleen and Alicia was out in front of the theater on 45th Street. Yeah. And Broadway was like it for me. Like that was my dream of dreams, right?
I mean,
and
how about working with Sally Field? Sorry.
Not yeah, no, that, story, was that was amazing. Yeah. It was a good year. My best acting year followed my worst acting year. You know what I mean? So I felt some wind at my sails just because I worked, I think, 8 or 9 months out of that year straight. You know, I just worked. And I made some money for the first time. And I felt like I was a lead in a Broadway show. And I was 27 years old. And it just changed something for me internally. I was like, oh, I might not be imagining this. Like, I keep getting cast.
Yeah.
And I might... Because I've always battled, like, I float between, like, massive inflated ideas of myself and, like, crushing disbelief in myself. And it just depends on the day or the moment.
Sure.
So I'm always navigating... You know, I can do anything. And like, why would anyone ever hire me for anything? So it's hard sometimes to be swinging.
I feel that way sometimes,
you know,
too.
It's hard to be swinging between those two, especially when I was younger. I have a more centered idea about it now. But when I was younger, it was like, oh my God. It took me so long to get over imposter syndrome and this idea that I've been just tricking people, that they were going to come and whisk me away. And
I feel like that all the time. Like, I don't belong here.
I don't know that anyway. The more I talk to people, especially like as you start talking to people who like literally have Academy Awards and stuff,
and
I'm like, oh, the Academy Award doesn't take away that feeling, which means maybe I don't need to stress over that feeling because maybe it will never go away.
Right.
And maybe that's what motivates you. I was talking with my friend Greg, who's a novelist, and he was saying that like everyone he knows who's truly great as a writer like is terrified that they're horrible. So they work doubly hard to disprove that to themselves. Where the people that kind of think like, yeah, I wrote something pretty terrific. It's generally, you know what I mean? Like it's often not. I think a certain amount of healthy, I don't know, like skepticism about your own abilities can be good.
It's like Golda Meir said, not to get all Jewy, but like, don't be so humble. You're not that great. Like
we've already passed the, we started this thing very Jewy.
Yeah,
exactly.
I think Golda Meir quotes, this is a safe space.
We can only get less Jewish.
I love my Golda. She's so great. But yeah, like my writing partner says, like, you're not a good writer if you think you're a good writer.
Yeah. Or sometimes I will think I've written something good. You'll go back and read it the next day and you're like, I was drunk. Like, this is terrible. Or, you know, sometimes I think with writing, the best you can hope for is that's like almost what I meant to say.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that's almost how I conceived it in that beautiful space in my mind before it came out of my fingertips, kind of wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I also think that very intelligent, good writers have a very high bar in general. They have good taste.
Yeah. Well, so that's that great, you know, that Ira Glass quote, that famous quote. Yeah. It's so true because your taste does develop before your abilities.
Yeah.
So everything is not going to meet your standards.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Although it can be hard. I know some people that never get out of the paralysis caused by their taste.
Huh.
So I think it's just good to fail. I didn't realize how much this is your podcast. I didn't realize how much failure would be a part of my career.
Yeah.
I just thought like, no, so it has to be, success has to be it. And it's so annoying, but you just learn infinitely more from failure. And most of it's failure anyway, you know?
Yeah, and I honestly don't think you can achieve, this is from doing the show for how many years? Like 3 years?
Yeah.
Like and talking to so many people. We just talked to someone that had a spinal cord injury playing football. You know, and he sounds like the happiest man.
Yeah.
And it's like, sometimes the success or the taste of it doesn't come unless you've failed a certain degree.
100%. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's funny when you ask about big breaks, like, I'm still looking for them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I still need a couple breaks. It's not like...
It's a good feeling. Why not?
It is a good feeling because I still feel hungry. I don't feel like I'm can kick back at the pool or anything.
I don't think anyone should. Like, I think it is kind of like food. Like, yeah, we need it sometimes. Sometimes we have enough and we're good. Yeah. But we need to keep feeding ourselves.
I heard this great thing someone told me about that Chris Rock said, that success in show business is like you're on a roller coaster and it's like twists and turns and hills and it's scary and fun and amazing and exhilarating, and then you're like, "Woo, that was amazing," and then they're like, "Yeah, you got to go back to the line and wait again to ride, like there's a line." And you know, I've never I've actually diversified to the point where I don't even panic the slightest when I don't have anything going on, because I have so much going on that sure. I could be working on.
Yeah.
Elaine de Botton said this great thing that the best way to safeguard against disappointment is to have a lot going on. You know, you just, well, one, like Rise was canceled, and I'm like, well, I have five other careers I'm working on.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. You have other tabs open,
yeah.
so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
But where were those failures coming up? Like, were you doing a lot of auditioning and not getting roles? Or, I mean, it sounds like you're fairly successful, no?
Yeah, statistically, I think I was doing very, very well. And I had 1,000 auditions I didn't get.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a lot of times it's like adjusting your metric of what you call a failure or success. So for instance, your first couple years out of school, if you have casting directors that keep calling you into audition, that's a good sign. It means they believe in you. They're bringing you in front of directors or producers. If you have an audition where the feedback is you were terrific, but they just think you're a little young or not right for the role, that's a victory. You got to call that a victory. Not only booking the job isn't the only way to look at something as a victory.
Right.
My friend said to me, your first couple years out of school are not about getting jobs. They're about getting fans. You want people to know your work. They want people to trust that you're going to do well. And then, you know, failure. So getting fired from the pilot, that felt like a failure, but ultimately it ended up being a great triumph for me in a lot of ways. My dad actually hilariously calls that my big break.
Really?
Like he thinks that really is one of the reasons I went on to like do better things. It's just because it motivated me. It was like, I wanted to disprove that. I proved that woman wrong.
Yeah. I always tell people I don't give up because I have so many people that I have to prove wrong.
Yeah. And the, exactly. And the other thing is I heard, you know, the artists that you look up to and admire, they're just the ones who didn't quit.
Right.
That's all.
Right.
You know, there's so many people I know who were among the most talented people I've ever seen, whether I went to school with them or did plays with them. They're not acting anymore. And that doesn't have anything to do with talent. That has to do with like grit and resilience and the stomach.
They didn't have
the stomach for it.
It is definitely the stomach. Mm-hmm. But are they doing other things? Like, are they writing, directing?
Yeah. Some of them aren't in show business anymore.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing. I don't know if like it's acting necessarily as a part of the show business.
Yeah.
Thing,
yeah.
Because it's like you could venture off and direct and do other things. Yeah. Or write. Yeah. But showbiz needs a certain.
Yeah.
You need to build up your immunity to that.
Yeah.
And have a certain digestion to.
But then you know, there's certain things that even your successes have failure laced into them.
Yeah.
And of course. all your failures have success. Really close by.
Yeah.
So I think just getting a more complex view of things rather than like a dualistic, like this was good or bad.
You know? Right.
It's like, it's everything.
Right. Yeah.
So let's talk about the, you know, elephant in the room. Was it 2005 that you got How I Met Your Mother?
Yeah.
Were there many auditions? How did that all come about?
I found with roles that I get, they're quite easy to get.
Mm-hmm.
With roles I don't get, it's like every door feels locked.
Yeah.
I'm like, why won't this budge? And the ones you do get, it's like all the doors are open. Hmm. So I went in, I was the first person they saw on the very first day.
Wow. That's unheard of, no? Yeah. I mean, I don't know anything about acting, by the way, but that sounds...
Well, it was interesting because Carter and Craig, who created the show, this woman, Megan Brandman, cast it. And I had this agent at the time who, she said, the only power you have is to say no. And so I said no a lot to auditions. I had no basis for saying no. I just knew I was with a good agency. They were going to come along. If I didn't feel connected to it or I thought I would be bad for this role, I would be like, no, I don't want to audition. She'd be like, great.
Wow.
She never forced me to go in because she loved telling people no. She's like,
it makes you sound like, it gives you,
you got something going on.
Gives you have taste, you know, you're like, have taste. Yeah. So I had done, I'd done three pilots. So I did the one I got fired from, I did The Court with Sally Field, and I did this pilot with Rob Reiner and Mercedes Rule that was all improvised for NBC, mm-hmm. which I also thought would get picked up, and it never saw the light of day, but it was super fun. Rob directed
that
it.
That sounds
it was
great. Like,
it was awesome. It was about a family of therapists that all lived in a brownstone together.
They should reboot that.
I know. It was terrific. So it was to be my fourth pilot. I went in that first day, and they were really happy to see me because Megan had told them, they said, I have your Ted. His name is Josh Radner, but he's very picky. He doesn't go in for a lot of things. And they were like, oh, because everyone wants to like feel wanted, but also by the person who doesn't want anyone. So I had this reputation that kind of was serving me among the casting community, which was like, yeah, he's kind of picky. I had no basis for being picky. I just was, you know. I kind of treated myself like a little more, not in an arrogant way, just like, no, I don't want to do that. So anyway, I really liked the script. I thought it was charming. But I also had been fired from a multi-camera sitcom, so I had some scars around that.
Mm.
But it was the kind of script that I read, and I was like, I know how to do this. Like, I know how to play this guy. And I also felt like I knew where the traps were.
Yeah.
Like, I knew not to get too sentimental, but I knew to give it the great feeling it needed. And I knew how to undercut the sentimentality with a joke at the right moment. Like, I just understood it. I also read it over like 2 or 3 times and just had it memorized. Like, it was written in such a way that it was so easy to memorize. So I did that. By the time I got to the car after the audition, I had a test deal. I was the only person. Wow. I think I was the only person they brought to Network and Studio.
So you knew you nailed it right there.
Yeah, I did. And then I auditioned with Kobe. We like went through the whole process together.
Wow.
Yeah, I remember the first time seeing Kobe Smulders around the corner and walk the hall towards me. She was like 23.
Yep.
Yeah.
Here's the other little connection that we have. Kobe actually lived in my place for a little while. She dated she dated my friend right before she got How I Met Your Mother.
Yes. Oh, okay. And also before she got Taryn Killam.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yes. So, yeah. And actually, he just got married, my old roommate. He still owes me $400+ for utilities, by the way. I just want to put that out there.
Such a Jew.
God. Every roommate that I've ever had owes me money for utilities. I'm serious.
I don't like Jewish money jokes. Can we talk about them?
Yes, let's talk about that.
I feel like it's such a pernicious stereotype that's not based in reality. And I don't like it when Jews make those jokes. I'm sorry to come on your podcast.
I'm not. No. It's fine. I don't like them either, really. I mean, I get kind of mad when people say like...
Like, you'd be so angry if a non-Jew said that to him.
What do you mean?
I agree. I mean,
yeah, exactly. Right. I know.
Yes. They're not. Yes.
Yeah. They're not. I don't make those jokes like on stage or anything.
I actually had
just
to another Jew from a Jew. It's like I can make a Holocaust joke.
I don't even think it's like it's not based in anything other than this pernicious like stereotype that's been going on. Well,
here's the thing behind it. I think more. I don't like the stereotype behind it at all. But I think by making a joke of it. Is like taking the power away from it.
I disagree. But I don't know why I disagree. But I disagree.
I also don't know, are we really rich or are we really cheap? Or are we both rich?
I've never found Jewish people to be tighter with the dollar than other people.
I swear to God, my whole life, I've like because of that stereotype, I've made sure to be more generous.
Yes. I'm not kidding. I feel like...
I'm like, I'll buy dinner. It's okay.
I feel like I need to... Like, I don't understand that. And I feel like all my Jewish friends are the same way. They're like, oh, I got to give extra because I don't want them to think this way.
Right. Well, not only that, my parents were never acquisitive. Like, we were very... We just drove Hondas. Like, we were very... Like, I've always thought ostentatious displays of wealth where it's hard to be in California because I'm like, why would you do that? But... You know, they taught me to be financially, like fiscally responsible. Like every Jewish parent's like, don't get credit card debt. Pay off your credit card every. Weren't you taught that?
Absolutely.
Pay off your credit card every month. Like stuff like that, which I feel like is just sound. Right. Because it's like, don't get into money trouble.
No, of course.
Yeah.
But the idea that like money is some sort of motivating force for like a people, I don't buy it.
Yeah.
I don't buy it.
And I'm sure we've all had the, you know, like I've had people throw pennies at me quite literally.
What? Well, you know, when we played Dublin High School, mm-hmm. no joke, they would throw bagels and pennies on the court at the basketball games.
Yeah.
I would have eaten the bagel.
Well, but it's on the court already, so you really don't want to. But yeah, I've been called all kinds of awful things. And so,
you know what we would chant back at them?
What's that?
S-A-T. Because our scores were a lot higher.
We're going to college.
Maybe this is also the difference of growing up in an area where there were so many Jews and like
You know, I think in Columbus, Ohio, you wanted to preserve the good the goodwill and the good name and the you know, it wasn't like it certainly wasn't New York or New Jersey. It was there were 15,000 Jews there.
Right.
To be honest,
though, literally count how many Jews.
Maybe more. I might be wrong about that.
Yeah, like my first taste of like goy people was like when I went to college because I went to Jewish high school, and actually the stereotype that I heard a lot, they're like, "Oh, your parents must be in the business. Like, you don't need help getting a job in Hollywood. Your dad must be a producer." And I'm like, "No, my dad's an engineer." And like, and I felt like people thought that my dad was in the business and was Steven Spielberg. I think that's what they had in mind. Hmm. Not so much a money thing, but yeah. Anyway.
Okay.
I will not make any more money jokes. I do agree. It's tacky and like not correct. And very not like
no, but, you know,
not based on anything.
Not to defend anything, but I definitely do the like it's that self-deprecation, right? Where you're like, I'm going to make that Jew joke before you can make that Jew joke about me. So I've done that. I don't do the money one so much, but I've definitely I've done the, you know, I've made the Jew jokes before. So
good for you.
Let's get off the Jew jokes. Side note, how did you get into transcendental meditation?
I had this girlfriend who battled anxiety, mm-hmm. and I found myself one day just giving her this long talk about how she needed to meditate. You know, when you try to change someone in a relationship, yeah. and it always works.
Yeah, always,
always, 100%. Always. Oprah was awesome right thing. About it.
And yep. So I was telling her to meditate, and we ended up breaking up. And then I realized how much anxiety I had.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I think I need to meditate. Yeah. And through a couple twists and turns, I was just introduced to this meditation teacher. And he was like the kind of assistant to the Maharishi for years.
Wow.
He like left home to travel with him when he was like 16. Mm-hmm. And I studied with him for a number of years and then left. I'm always leaving teachers. I'm always finding and leaving teachers.
Why is that?
I think...
Find the next great thing?
No, I think I fall into certain guru seductions, and then when they're revealed to be human, I have to deal with that.
Right.
I think I've hopefully had my last round with that, but I'm susceptible to that.
But are you still doing TM?
I do.
Twice a day?
No, I generally do it once a day, okay. but I sometimes get the second one, but I mostly do it once.
And do you think that it has changed your life for the better?
Well, I started doing it in 2004, and my life did change within the year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I do find that I'm able to do a lot, you know, and one of the benefits of it is productivity and all that. And
yeah.
they say it's more, you know, powerful than sleep. I don't know if I believe that, but I do feel that just getting your eyes closed, especially in the culture we live in,
yeah.
like the benefits of non-doing in a society that's about nothing but doing, it can't be overstated. That said, I come up with all sorts of reasons not to meditate, and I'll take them.
Oh, yeah.
Know? Yeah.
I remember I was struggling. I had a period where I was really, really anxious, and I went to, you know, Brian Kopelman?
Yeah, I met him last week.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I did a reading of one of the writers from Billions. Adam Perlman wrote this play. I did the play, met Brian. He was
nice. Oh, yeah.
Really
so
nice.
I emailed him being like, Brian, I don't know what to do. I can't, I feel like I can't write anymore. And I'm like, I'm anxious all the time. And he's the one who kind of introduced me to TM.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And like, but he's super into it.
Oh,
like,
really? Who taught him?
I'm not even sure. Yeah, I don't know who
it
taught
kind
him.
Of in the last it's decade, weird. I feel like went around Hollywood, like everyone kind of.
Yeah, everyone
I know
was
like
doing it.
Like Bob Roth at the you know, the David Lynch Foundation,
right.
like they'll come to sets and they'll yeah. train anyone,
yeah.
you know, who wants to do it.
Yeah. And so Brian, and he's in New York and was yeah. like doing it, just like just telling me, like, you know, via email and whatever, like all this info about it, where I can like find out how to do it in LA, mm-hmm. and all this stuff.
Did you learn?
I didn't learn myself. I went to one workshop, but I'm not a like easy person to meditate, but he's the one who like got me really interested in meditating at all. And yeah. then I started going to, do you know the Den? You
know,
the meditation studio?
Yes.
So I started going there and I started doing other
things. Well,
no
one's good at meditation.
Yeah.
Naturally. Like you just have to learn.
You know who owns the Den?
I know who owns the Den.
Yes. Okay.
Tal Rabinowitz.
Correct.
Oh, I know her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she's great. Yeah. I love her.
I think she was at... She used to work at the WB?
Yeah. No. She worked at ABC.
Oh, is that
yes.
it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And now married to Alex Sulkin.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I didn't even know TM was such a big thing in Hollywood until Brian told me. He's like, oh, yeah, so-and-so's doing it. And mm-hmm. like this person swears by it. And I had no idea it
Howard
even existed.
Stern.
Howard
yeah.
Stern's
Stern,
a big TM.
He's yeah. a big TM. Yeah.
yeah.
So I didn't know it was so helpful for so many people.
I think it's really good for very busy people.
Yeah.
You know, to just be like, okay, I do it first thing in the morning and then I close my, you know, at 4 o'clock, 4 to 4:20, right? That's where I meditate. And then I just go on with my day.
Yeah. Do you find certain windows of the day, like if you can't do it twice a day, one's like you have to do it? The morning one or?
The morning one is so much easier to get just because you can always get up 20 minutes earlier.
Sure.
You know? The second one has always been a little hard to strategize to get. The my teacher used to say, just make it non-negotiable. Like it's not, you're going to sit in the Whole Foods parking lot and you're going to do it.
Oh, really?
You know? Yeah.
Wow.
I've done that. I've done it on planes. I've done it in parking lots. Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah.
That's, I think a plane would be a great
plane
thing
would
to
be
do
great.
It.
Planes are great. Yeah. Cause it's also like the noise machine of the engine is kind of lulls you.
I know. Yeah. But I loved though the idea of not closing your eyes, not doing anything, without the purpose of sleeping.
Right.
which was very freeing.
It's yeah. it's different.
I mean, I, you know.
You like it?
I'm not a TM. I've never done TM, but I do meditate, and TM is something that I'm interested in. I mean, I'm not even sure.
Brian will hook you up.
References. One of my friends said to me, she said, pay $1,000, you'll find out what your mantra is, and I'm like, that's not what TM is, right? Like, it's not the difference between meditation and transcendental meditation.
It's, you know, like, it's both a liberation that'll change your life, and it's a total racket all at the same time, you know? And you just kind of have to decide, like, how committed you are to it. Like, my teacher, you could pay what you wanted. I think it was, like, a $200 minimum.
Okay.
But he would say, you know, think of your weekly, what you make per week. Like, a week's earnings is what he called it. But I would always tell people, like, if you give the minimum, that's how committed you are to it. Like, give enough so that it pinches a little bit.
Yeah.
You know?
It's like going to the gym. If you're never going to go, then, like...
Yeah, like a free membership, you probably wouldn't use as much as if you... So, I also, you know, the TM, like, the TM organization, like, through the Maharishi, like, they talk about... You know, if 10% of the population meditated, the world would be in bliss.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't know if that's true.
I don't know if that's true.
I don't know if that's true. I mean, like, cool I me, do think but... they've done all these studies that, like, you know, where meditation centers are, the crime within a certain amount of area, like, plummets.
Oh.
You know, that there's a kind of measurable effect of where, like, large groups of meditators are. All of which I could buy that. You know? But, because I do think that there's a... I don't know. I think it's contagious. I think higher consciousness, low consciousness is contagious, and so is higher consciousness. So,
we had a meditation minion at my high school.
Really?
Which I took because we had minions first thing in the morning. And I was like, oh, I get to kind of sleep. But yeah.
You know what I've done?
So dumb.
The last few New Year's is meditated from like 11:45 to 12:15.
Wow.
That's brilliant.
Really cool.
I don't like New Year's. I don't like having to feel pressure to do something.
Any forced conviviality I hate.
And forced like celebration at a weird time too, like midnight. Like, so you go to a party at like 11:30, 11? Like, that seems weird to me.
Yeah.
What are you going to do from like 6 p.m. till 11?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's good that you have something to do. Schedule your meditation then. Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay. Time for our second to last question. So, what do you feel like your biggest failure is?
My biggest failure.
You can come back to us.
And it doesn't have to be.
You know, meditate on it.
It could be anything.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like such a can of worms, and I sometimes hate talking about this stuff because I did that show for so long, and because you get so identified with a character, especially that character who had just so much life and experience over 208 episodes that nothing I say, anything I say, people will be like, huh, it's just like that episode where whatever, dot, dot, dot.
Oh,
and I find it maddening and exhausting. But, and I don't even know if I want to go down the rabbit hole of this, but I am unmarried and I don't consider that like a problem, but I don't feel like a relationship expert.
Right.
So I guess it would be in relationship, but I have also taken a lot of time to heal some stuff and to seek some good, you know, solid guidance on this.
Yeah.
So I feel in a good place in certain ways, but not, I would never be like if I got invited to speak, right, as an expert and they were like, can you speak about the course of like becoming an actor? I'd be like, yes, I could speak about that with some authority. I think I've picked up a lot of tools along the way.
Yeah.
But if they were like, could you speak on like healthy relationships? I'd be like, maybe you could find someone else for that. And I don't know that anyone feels
they're
a relationship expert, but
Esther Perel, maybe. She's great, but is she
in a relationship? I don't know.
But is Esther Perel, is she in a relationship?
Yeah. Or I mean, and again, I don't think that people who are in relationships are necessarily like more evolved or more successful at life.
Yeah.
It's just
I don't think anybody can be really an expert at anything. Like where everybody's still learning, and relationships is very specific too, because it's two different people.
Yeah.
Like two completely different people, and no one can be an expert on that. Like combination.
Mm-hmm.
It's very hard to
achieve. And it's so much trial and error, and it's so much, it just works when it works and it doesn't when it doesn't.
I just love when I'm complaining about my own problems and my married friends are like, oh, you don't know, but we know.
And it's not like all the married people are like, they all want you to get married, but then it's like they also seem to report that it's not an easy thing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Why don't you get married? Then it's like, my fucking husband You're like, oh yeah, well that maybe I don't want
to
get
the other day that my friend's like, oh, I'm so excited to you're coming to my wedding. I'm like, yay. She's like, are you seeing anyone? Because like, I don't want to put more people. I don't want to invite more people. Like our list is like, and I'm like, no, just me. And she's like, okay, phew. Because like, I didn't want to have to pay for someone else. And I'm like, what? So I'm like basically her pity. Like, oh, okay, we'll take her because she's not bringing a plus one.
Yeah, I have a friend who just went to a wedding and she said, I was the only single person there like 20 to 80. Like, you know, the year. And she's like, her friends were like prepping her, like, are you okay? What, are you going to be okay? Like, what can we do for you?
Yeah. What? Well, the worst is everybody gets up and you're sitting at the table alone, like, oh, isn't this nice? That, it's like, I'm alone.
Are you married?
No, I'm single.
We're both single.
Yeah.
So we know the struggle.
The struggle's real.
I'm not an expert. I'm not an expert on anything, though. But so you think relationships is where, like, you feel like you failed the most?
Well, it's the area that I feel the least like I could, you know, do a tight 20 on. Like I mean, I have thoughts about it.
Okay.
But I don't. My friend, a friend of mine who's now married with kids, but she said years ago, she was like, why don't all my friends come to me for relationship advice? She goes, I have 100% failure rate in relationships, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just I've been able to do this thing that is statistically very hard to do. And I keep doing it. And I've been, you know, I keep writing and I keep directing. I'm now like, I picked up the guitar a year and a half ago and I'm like playing in front of paying audiences, you know? And so I'm able to crack the codes of so much. And that one's still, that's a work in progress for me, you know?
It's a hard one though. It's a really difficult one. And I honestly tell my therapist this all the time. When I see someone happily married for a very long time, I'm like, that is a miracle.
Yeah.
We are witnessing a miracle.
And I also don't say this with any self-pity. It's not like...
You don't sound it.
Yeah. It's just like, that's, you know...
You can't learn this thing, too. I don't think you can learn
relationships. There's no courses on it. There's no... It's just...
Can't go to Tisch for relationships.
Yeah. Yeah. I asked my brother, my younger sister... Both my sisters are married and have two kids, and... I asked my younger sister, because she didn't have long relationships before she met her husband at all, like a couple months tops.
Yeah.
And his longest relationship was a year, and they've now been married over a decade. And I said, how did you guys know how to have a good relationship? And they're like, we didn't. We still don't. We're figuring it out as we go, you know? And they are. I think they have a great relationship, but I think that they've never fallen into a... They've never, you know, taken their foot off the gas. Like, they're like, we're still working.
Yeah.
That's good.
And I'm not going to ask the last question yet, because I just do want to mention, you said you are in a band with Ben Lee. Yes.
Correct.
Who was a former guest on our show as well. What's the name of the band?
Radner and Lee.
Okay. That's original. What kind of music is this?
It's like two guys singing sweet harmonies.
Okay.
We write all the songs. They're all original. We had one cover on our first album. We're kind of recording/paused on recording our second album, but we keep getting better at writing songs together. And I really like the first batch of songs we wrote, but I love the second. And we've toured Brazil and Argentina and Australia and the Midwest and New York and LA. And it's just become a thing. Like we've been friends for a really long time, about 12 or 13 years. And we started writing songs 3 years ago together, and it's just been a blast. And yeah, we just keep doing it. I don't love the road, exactly. I mean, I like performing in front of people from all different places. But I also am going to record a solo record, because I've written 40 songs without Ben.
Wow.
Once I discovered guitar, that was it for me. I was like, this is the best thing ever. I can't believe I didn't play for so long.
Huh.
See, you've got other stuff going on.
Yeah, I do. Who has time for a relationship?
So now our final question. What is your favorite charity?
What is my favorite charity? Mm-hmm. Locally or internationally?
You tell me.
Whichever one needs money.
Well, so I was really affected by that Nicholas Kristof book, Half the Sky.
Oh,
did you read that book?
It's
basically about how if you care about geopolitics or about developing nations, investing in education for women is the number one thing that changes a country and changes a family. And like, so it's something like women hold up half the sky, right? So my friend Mia, who I went to grad school with, her partner, Lars, his mother is a woman named Razia Jan, or Jean, Jan. She's Afghani. She raised him, I think, in Boston, but she went back to Kabul and started a girls' school there.
Wow.
That's so ambitious.
Called Razia's Ray of Hope. And that's what the, I think the website is just Rosio's Ray of Hope. They started with kindergarten, like, and just kept building it. They did it in high school, and now they have a college.
Wow.
And it's just keeps exploding. And she is a, she was actually one of the CNN heroes.
You know,
they do that every year.
Yeah.
And she's become a friend, and hilariously, she's the biggest How I Met Your Mother fan in the world. I mean, she's so fangirled around
me. Oh my God.
But she also, she couldn't get season 7, 8, and 9 out in Kabul for some reason. So I sent them to her.
Oh.
Because she said, that's what I do late at night. Wow. Like, I watch your show.
Oh my God.
It was so sweet. But, you know, I go to their fundraisers every year.
That's so great.
And I try to let people know about it. It's an amazing. Oh, and I will say this because this will show you what a genius she is and how difficult, you know, she stood up to like masked gunmen. Mm-hmm. Like, she's like, she's a badass, like truly. And there's all these fathers that don't want their kids to go to these schools, right? I think this was when it was starting. So the very first class, the very first day, the first thing she taught these girls to do on the very first day was she taught them all how to spell their father's names. So they came home and said, look, Dad, I can spell your name, but a lot of these fathers are illiterate and they don't know how to spell their name and they don't know how to write it.
Wow.
So immediately, within 24 hours, the fathers, they come back the next day with tears in their eyes and they say, you have changed my family, because they can get loans from banks now. Huh. They can do all sorts of business they weren't able to do before that. So she immediately empowers these girls to give something to the family.
Wow.
that is immediately shows an effect.
Wow.
Yeah.
$100 going to Razia's Rampo. It doesn't feel like enough.
I know. Yeah. I feel like we're not donating enough.
She's extraordinary.
We should have a Patreon.
And just these videos of watching these girls. And it's really so moving.
Go look it up, everyone.
Well, it will be in the bio of the show. You know, and every show we donate, there's always the link to the donate page. So link, click in there, donate some money for yourself. Why not? Josh, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Really appreciate it. Had a great time. Eden, thank you.
Thank you, Guy, for
and thank you for listening.
Everything. Bye.
Bye.